This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, an activist with the Black Alliance for Peace urges anti-war and environmental groups to make their movements look more like the people of planet Earth. And the chairman of the Jericho Movement talks about the plight of America's aging political prisoners, in particular the attack on former Black Panther Herman Bell. But first, the media is full of discussion nowadays about racist behavior, but not much attention is paid to the actual material conditions of Black life in the United States. Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong recently wrote an article on the precarious financial state of Black families. It's titled Black America, the Wealthless Community.
In my piece, I talk about a recent study by the Economic Policy Institute and Prosperity Now, which basically reports a gloomy forecast for Black wealth in the United States and the future of Black wealth in the United States, where they study future trends that point to the fact that by 2053, Black wealth in the U.S. will be zero. And this comes just 2 years after the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, here where I am located, did a study on Black wealth just in the city of Boston, where U.S.-born Blacks or Black Americans who do not identify themselves as having lineage in the Caribbean region were identified to already have wealth that is equal to zero, a net worth of zero, or very close to that, statistically insignificant. So basically what these studies point to is the fact that despite all of this conversation about racism that's in the political discourse now, none of these studies have really reached the level of mainstream political discourse in the United States. And I believe that's intentional. A lot of the conversation about racism right now is really geared toward the electoral arena. It's geared towards the Trump administration. And it really has very little to do with the material circumstances of Black people or oppressed people in the United States. And that goes for immigration, too. I feel like a lot of the arguments about immigration have not really talked about the economic and material reasons why immigration is an issue either. So what these studies really point to is the fact that U.S. capitalism and imperialism is on a path of destruction, and it cannot stop. And what's really striking about the study, and I think this has been true since 2013, is that Black median wealth is only $1,700 when you subtract things like automobiles and phones and luxury couches or whatever people buy these days called durable goods. When that's subtracted, the middle Black family only has $2,000 worth of cash assets to use in case of an emergency, to obtain basic needs. So if we think about this, we see that the Black America in the United States is in a precarious position. And much of that, if not all of that, happened under the Obama administration and beforehand. And none of it's being talked about now, even in an era where we see race relations really being a topic of conversation.
And maybe more precarious than this study projects. The study says that Black folks will reach zero wealth in 2053, 36 years from now, but that's based upon incremental changes based upon the current rate. But history doesn't act incrementally all the time. There are crises, and capitalism is in the midst of a crisis and can be expected to generate a lot more crises in the next 36 years, if it lasts that long.
Exactly. The U.S. capitalist system is in a state of stagnation. Growth in the U.S. economy, capitalist economy, is only projected to be 1 to 2% for the next couple of decades. What that means is that at any given moment, the contradictions of capitalism could lead to another collapse. just as big, if not bigger, than 2007 and 2008, when Black America lost much of its existing wealth at that time, which led to a decrease in wealth from, I think it was $6,800 net worth down to the $1,700 we see now. So that could happen again. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the police brutality, the mass incarceration that is really meant to socially control and repress the Black community as it suffers through one of the worst economic eras that it has ever faced in the United States, especially post-emancipation. So, you know, here we are talking about Black wealth yet on Black Agenda Report, but when we look at the corporate media in places like MSNBC, all we see are Black faces saying things like they have more in common with people, neocons like Max Boot and these anti-Russia Cold War hysterics who are really looking just for war and are completely ignoring the problems on the ground that are affecting Black people and poor people as a whole. And that's the situation right now, and it's a very explosive situation. It could materialize into rebellion, I think, at any given moment. So it's a real interesting time.
We've seen a lot of discussion about the export of jobs over the last decades, but not as much about automation taking jobs, although automation was responsible for many of the job losses in the past few decades. For Black folks who are no longer a necessity and not even valuable probably as a reserve army of the unemployed, automation is a real killer.
Exactly. And the correlation, the connection between really the permanent automation, really automation in the past under U.S. capitalism and capitalism as a whole, used to be a part of generating more growth. But now we see the stagnation happening where automation is seen as a permanent fixture of the U.S. capitalist economy, where entire jobs are completely eliminated. And what that has meant for Black America is that there are millions of people without, Black people especially, without jobs and will never have jobs. And that's something that isn't talked about at all. There have been mainstream reports in the corporate media that have talked about how a lot of jobs, 40-ish percent of jobs by 2030 that exist now will be automated. And this is where repression and the state comes in to manage this explosive labor situation, especially when the Black community is concerned, where even in the midst of all these cosmetic changes that the Obama administration made to the mass incarceration regime, we still see that number, 2.3 million, remain static. And it remains to be seen how the U.S. capitalist class, the ruling class, will be able to rectify and wrestle with the fact that a lot of Black people are going to be unemployed permanently. And that means the only option that this system has is to wage war against them. So how that is reconciled on the ground, where a Black person is killed every 28 hours and over almost 50% of the prison population identifies as Black, that's really going to be an explosive situation we really need to watch out for. But there's a lot of challenge to this when we have the orange spectacle in the White House, who has taken a lot of people's energy and consciousness towards whatever the corporate media is saying, and we have to fight that right now.
According to that studies that you cite in your article, less than 15% of Black households are in possession of what we could call middle class wealth, enough wealth to categorize them as middle class. But the same study shows that only 18% of whites have middle class wealth, and that 42% of those households, white households, are asset poor. White folks aren't doing well either.
And that's something that is very striking about the study that I cite in my article, which really isn't talked about in the study at all. It's sort of just a comparative number, but it should be telling, to say the least, because what we've seen since the Trump administration and the Trump campaign and the whole disarray and chaos that was the 2016 elections, which have yet to end, is that this conversation of the white working class, quote unquote, or working class whites, has made its way into the political lexicon and conversation in the United States in a very unhelpful way. Because what has happened is that this notion of the white working class has been disconnected from working class blacks and people who consider themselves Latinos and other racial groups in the United States, which have been arguably suffering more. But it also takes away from the fact that U.S. capitalism as a system is at a race to the bottom and has been attacking the living standards and conditions of all workers and unemployed people in the United States. And that includes white Americans. And that number, which is very telling, shows that even within the so-called white American community, there is a huge amount of stratification and inequality that has been getting worse, maybe not to the same degree, but definitely at a rate that is worth noting, because it points to the fact that we may have a common enemy here and we may be able to forge some semblance of unity among the poor and oppressed here in the United States that could be useful in the future.
Yes, the numbers tell the tale. There is a general deterioration, which also affects white America, but the question is, who do they blame?
Exactly. And that's one of the interesting and troubling phenomena. I feel it's been a parallel phenomenon where there is a lot of unrest in the United States. But what we saw in the 2016 elections is that the Trump campaign was able to mix economic populism with state racial scapegoating in order to generate support from certain sections of the white population that supported Obama during his campaign. And what we also saw, which I think is equally important and may actually be more important in this moment when we're talking about organizing purposes, is we saw a whole lot of people in the general election just not vote at all. And I feel like a lot of those people happen to be those who are either unable to vote for a lot of the various reasons, but that occurs especially in black neighborhoods in the South. But also a lot of people just decided not to because of the conditions in the United States, and that left a big vacuum for Trump to take advantage of, despite the fact that he wasn't the favorite. So even though there is a lot of confusion, I feel like the material conditions are there. We have to start working with what is real on the ground and what people are experiencing day to day. But I feel like people such as Ta-Nehisi Coates and various other commentators in the corporate media especially are attempting to paint this period as one that is characterized primarily and solely through the lens of racial animus towards the former black president. And that is completely missing the bigger picture here, and it's intentionally, and people like him intentionally do that. So I feel like when we're talking about black wealth and we're talking about wealth in general, we're really talking about capital, and we're talking about the social relations that dictate who has capital, who doesn't, and what one has to do to get that capital. Either you own capital and you're able to invest it and you're able to exploit labor and resources in order to accumulate more of it, or you're selling your body and your labor as capital in order to survive. And what we're seeing right now is that those social relations becoming so apparent, and the contradictions that arise from that, those social relations are becoming so visible that the U.S. imperial apparatus in Washington is having a hard time distracting the population from what's going on. There's so much unrest on the ground that what we see is this rabid war drive towards Russia, which has culminated in this committee to investigate Russia, a handful of neocons, including Rob Reiner and Morgan Freeman and these bourgeois rejects, have decided to invest some resources in rehashing and keeping this narrative against Russia going. And I think in large part, not just to wage war against Russia, but also to make it seem like there is an enemy that the people of the United States, especially struggling people in the United States, need to focus on other than their own capitalist class and imperialist ruling class, which is the cause of all the suffering that they experience day to day. And so this is really what we need to start talking about, and conversations and things like studies on black wealth are really helpful. However, they're not helpful if we just talk about the numbers and we don't talk about what we need to do about it.
Yes, the study suggests a federal jobs program. They want an increase in the minimum wage, and they suggest elimination of predatory lending. These are worthwhile things to do, but they're not solutions to the black economic crisis or the general crisis of capitalism.
No, they're not. Those could be turned into demands. They call them policy solutions, as if they're something to lobby for in Washington, when Washington is in complete control of the neocons, and most people see Washington as little but trouble if one looks at the approval ratings of the presidents and Congress and the media too. What we really have to do is build a movement on the ground that is able to articulate these demands and put pressure on the U.S. imperial apparatus in Washington to meet these demands. Right now, what we're seeing in Washington is a drive towards World War III and economic collapse. This is what the recent military budget that has been signed off on by the Senate and Congress, which increases the amount of money spent on the military that even Trump was proposing before, I think, by several billion dollars, actually. So here we are with the U.S. imperial apparatus ready to wage war against the future of the world, which I say is China and all of the nations that seek to align itself with China. And we have this problem of what are we going to do about the material conditions that working class people and oppressed people face here. And Black America's wealth problem, the fact that Black America will be a wealthless community very soon, probably sooner than what the Economic Policy Institute says. So we have this real opportunity right now to connect these things, because Trump was just at the UN General Assembly talking about annihilating North Korea and the DPRK. And now we have this huge military budget that's signed, but very little conversation, if any conversation at all, has happened around the question of black wealth and the question of endless war. And those are probably the two most central questions to the future of the United States.
Black Agenda Report contributing writer Denny Haifong. Peace and environmental activists came together for an historic conference in Washington, D.C. to explore ways to strengthen collaboration between the two movements. One of those on hand was Reverend Lukata Mjumbe, a black minister in Irvington, New Jersey, and veteran human rights and environmental justice activist. Reverend Mjumbe is on the coordinating committee of the Black Alliance for Peace.
As the coordinator of the African American Environmental Justice Action Network in the 90s, I worked throughout communities in the Black Belt South, and I discovered there the very real intersectionality between the environment and between our peace movements. Because what I witnessed in these communities was economic violence. What I witnessed was the kind of violence that Dr. King talked about. Dr. King did not simply talk about and simply did not bring our attention to the violence of institutional racism and the violence that occurred when men and women and children would go and march for civil rights. He talked about, particularly when he went to the slums in Chicago, about the economic violence as being even more surmountable in many ways than the violence of what was seen in the Jim Crow South. And I saw economic violence in places like Brunswick, Georgia, in places like Anniston, Alabama, where we saw the intersection of the environmental and the peace movements. In Anniston, Alabama, they were attempting at the time to locate a chemical weapons incinerator right near where Monsanto Chemical Company also happened to be located, right near the fence line where there was a black and brown community that lived right there, and there were children and there were women who were dealing with levels of cancer, levels of physical destruction that was directly tied to the toxic contamination that was being spewed into the water. into their air, into the soil, into the places where they lived and where they worked and where they played. And so we saw that intersection. We see the relationship. We must see the relationship. That we cannot truly be talking about saving this earth if we are not talking about saving the people of this earth. And when, amen. So we bring these things together, and when we combine them, we begin to change our perspective. We begin to come up with new questions. We begin to come up with new answers. We begin to come up with different thoughts and processes. And when I think about the Black Alliance for Peace, we stand upon the tradition of those like Martin King, who I mentioned, but we also stand upon the tradition of those like Malcolm X. And people might say, Malcolm X, peace? Absolutely. 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 Because Malcolm X understood that the source of violence that was experienced in this country was white supremacy. We saw that in Charlottesville, Virginia. Malcolm X understood. Malcolm X understood that we can never allow ourselves to be put in what he called the trick bag of whenever we talk about defending the integrity of our communities and our lives, that we are being said to be committing violence. It is violence to have people not have the food that they need to eat, or when you fill them up with food, you fill them up with food that is hazardous, that is contaminated, that is toxic, and even though they will have a full belly, they will not have a full life. That is a violence that we must resist today, and as we combine our movements globally, we will have perspectives that begin to change. I'll also say that as we embrace the challenge of combining our movements globally, we have to recognize it's not simply reaching across from one movement into the next. It's about bringing our movements together, and if we are going to sit together, if we are going to come up with new perspectives, we have to be able to understand each other. Our challenges that we've had in our movements for a very long time is, how do we speak? How do we communicate? How do we publish? How do we share information that is available to people who do not speak English as their first language? This is a critically important challenge to combining our movements. If we think that we can just go wherever it is that we go, and we can just enter into those places and be the same white, be the same American, be the same English speaking, be the same privileged people without even making the adjustment of speaking in the language of the people who we claim that we're going to struggle alongside, who we claim that we are trying to combine our movements with, then we have already betrayed the integrity of our movements even before we've opened our mouths. I was in Nigeria just this past March, and one of the activities that I was involved in while I was there was a clean water campaign. And a clean water campaign, and we were in Lagos, Nigeria, and there were many people in Lagos, Nigeria, because it's a former British colony, that speak English. But as I began to talk with them about the clean water campaign that was organized by the Presbyterian Church of Nigeria, as I began to talk to them and I began to give them statistics and talk about the, and they were very well aware of how clean water was so important in their communities. But I had my talking points. I said what I needed to say. But then when they truly began to understand what I said, is with one person who may have been speaking Igbo translated what I said to someone else, and then the faces lit up. Ah, yes. So that's what you mean. And so the challenge of language and opening ourselves up to recognizing that in order to combine our movements globally, that we have to begin to deal with the challenge of language is important. I have experienced this recently. One of the things that the Black Alliance for Peace is very, very aware of and focused on, one of our leaders is in Colombia, now Colombia, South America, not Colombia, South Carolina. I have to frequently clarify that with some folks. But in Colombia, they're in the midst of the peace talks. And I'm trying to get information, and I'm on a listserv, and the information is coming back to me in Spanish, and my Spanish is okay, but I know that I'm getting about half of it. I'm understanding about half of what it is that is actually happening there, and it is something that I want us to all just be on the alert, not just from the language in general, but Colombia in particular. I was there in 2014. And it is very important that we recognize where the peace movement and where the environmental movement needs to show up, even in those places which aren't the typical type of coverage that we might get on CNN or MSNBC or even in some of our traditional environmental and peace organizations. Because even if bombs are not being dropped, the challenge and the front lines of the peace and environmental struggle are still there. In Colombia right now, the peace process is being threatened and compromised by messaging and communication and language which is being put out by the United States government. And even if the United States government does not drop a nuclear weapon, then it still has an impact in terms of making space for those who want to ravage the activists, the peace activists, the land rights activists, those who are standing up and trying to bring together reconciliation in that country. The doors are being opened for the far right wing paramilitary groups to begin to attack. And so we have to begin to open up our minds and our perspectives to see beyond what the things that we might normally be looking for if we're going to have answers that answer and solutions that solve. And so I want you to stay connected with us, the Black Alliance for Peace.com, particularly around the issue and the struggles in Colombia, because there are going to be some things that are going to be coming forward, and it's going to require for us to stand in and to stand up. And our leadership and our followership and our solidarity is really important. When I went to Colombia in 2014, you know, I again saw the intersection of the environmental and the peace movements. I saw the struggle of the guerrillas and the resistance movement and what was happening there. I saw what was coming with the gold mining companies that were stealing land from the Afro-Colombia community. I saw the violence and the attacks and the disappearing that was talked of in places like Buenaventura, Colombia. But then one of the things that was really interesting in a community that I went into, Buenaventura, it said something about one of the ways that we might be valuable. I was already there as a part of a delegation from the United States, and we were considered to be valuable because having people who carried American passports come into some of these places and countries, they knew that while we were there, and while we were observing, and while we were listening, and while we were watching, and while we were asking questions, no paramilitary group was likely to come in and kidnap someone and kill them in our presence and while we were there. And so they moved us around from place to place, and so we were receiving information, but we also recognized that our presence had some importance, and our connection of combining our movements together had some value. But then I really saw it when we went into one particular community in Buenaventura, and I saw a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white woman who was sitting on the porch. It was curious, not because I hadn't seen blonde-haired, blue-eyed white women before, but I just hadn't seen many in Buenaventura, Colombia, because the rest of the community was mostly an all-black and brown community. And so I went in and I talked to her, and I was surprised to find out that she was actually from the Presbyterian Church. And I said, well, what are you doing here? Why are you out here sitting on the porch? And she said, oh, thank goodness, somebody who speaks English. The value that she had in that community is they had a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white woman that sat on a porch, and that was her ministry. The fact that she was present in that place was better than any kind of guard dog, was better than any kind of soldier that they might have standing in front, because as long as she was there, as long as they knew that there was a connection that brought this movement and this community and connected them to the struggles in the United States and connected them to the eyes and the ears and the movements of people who were in the United States who have the ability to put pressure on federal government administrations, who have the ability to put pressure on corporations that were set up there in Colombia that were based in the United States, that they had a level of safety that they would not have enjoyed otherwise. I'm not saying that I need a bunch of blonde-haired, blue-eyed, or silver-haired, blue-eyed, white-skinned people just to go and sit down on porches in Buenaventura. But what I'm saying is that there is an opportunity. There is an opportunity for us to stand together, to listen to one another, to learn from one another. We stand on a tradition of a Paul Robeson, of a Du Bois, of a King, of a Malcolm X. We stand on the tradition of those women and men of the environmental justice movement and those who have fought for peace and against violence. We stand for those who are in local communities who recognize the connection between the militarization of police departments and the rescinding of policies that now allow police departments to bring in these weapons of war and use them on black and brown communities in D.C., in Chicago, in Atlanta, in Trenton, New Jersey. We recognize that that's the tradition that we stand on, but we need to stand with you. We need to stand with our traditional organizations. We need to challenge each other. We need to lean into discomfort. And when we do that, I believe that we can come up with true answers that answer and solutions that solve. Let us move forward together. Thank you.
That was Reverend Lukata Njumbe of the Black Alliance for Peace. The Jericho Movement does its best to represent the interests and welfare of political prisoners in the United States. The Jericho Movement's list is shrinking, not because the U.S. isn't creating new political prisoners, but because activists incarcerated in the 60s and the 70s are dying off. The surviving imprisoned radicals still catch hell from prison guards. 69-year-old former Black Panther Herman Bell was seriously injured when he was attacked by New York State prison guards last month. Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with the chairman of the National Jericho Movement, Jihad Abdul Mumit.
We represent about 40 political prisoners now. The list used to be larger, but some have passed away, some have been released. Some we were able to manage to be participants, active participants in their freedom. So the list is smaller, and we always go through the discussion, which is related directly to our organizational capacity to represent more, particularly the new wave of political prisoners from the activists and the revolutionaries on the street trying to bring about change, you know, and the ones that get arrested tomorrow, or whatever the case may be. But some of the ones that's on the radar right now is Herman Bell. He was part of the New York Three. And two Tuesdays ago, he was savagely beaten by prison guards. And there's a big uproar and clamor about that. And now you have an individual that's 69 years old. He has not had an incident report or a write-up, if you will, in 20 years. He's expecting a contact visit with his wife the next day or the day thereafter. And so why would he, in some secluded part of the prison yard, you know, attack the correctional officer? It just flies in the face of all logic. But there you have it. So we recognize this as an ongoing campaign, you know, of repression and violence against the freedom fighters that we represent that are in prison, and even the ones that we don't represent, and even the ones that we don't even know about. But that's fighting that uphill struggle to maintain their integrity and their principles, even on the inside. But the Donald Trump administration, for example, it's always been the case, but now it all stops a little, you know, in terms of the racism in prison, the repression, the violence, just the same way on the street. You know, police has almost seemed like they've given the green light to go haywire, if they will, because they got the word from all the way up from the top. But even before Donald Trump, you know, it's been a situation where those that are politically active, that have cases that are politically motivated, receive a lot of repression, undue repression from the state. The parole boards are repressive. They don't let them go. Even when time is served, as in the case of one particular brother, Veronza Bowers, whose time is up and he's been in prison now going on 2 decades extra over his time, which is so absurd that these things even continue to exist. We have prisoners that have medical conditions, including Herman Bell now, because a couple of his ribs were broken. I was told that he will get a CAT scan, and now he's being charged with assault. And, you know, it's just a situation that demands our attention, not only for Brother Herman, but for so many others that are in the exact same similar situation as he is. We have Jamil Abdul-Muteqin, who's been transferred and his property and stuff all over the place, because after being allowed to teach a Black History course, he mentioned the Black Panther Party, and then everything goes buck wild on him. We have Jan Lyman, who's being threatened to be put in a communication management union they call CMUs. They would totally truncate your communication. They have so many people, mostly Muslims, in these units to prevent any form of communication, you know, with the outside world, this inhumane form of long-term solitary confinement and isolation, which the UN has condemned repeatedly and questioned the United States on their treaty reviews with the rest of the world. Why are they doing this? So then we have medical conditions with a brother named Robert Hayes Seth, who has uncontrollable diabetes, and it took forever to get him a monitoring pump to modulate his sugar levels. It just was so purposely bureaucratic and dragged on for so long that his life is in peril now. We have another situation with a brother named Tom Manny, who has had so many multiple operations on all of his joints. We have Leonard Peltier, who just had triple bypass surgery. I don't know if the audience may know that. He's in Coleman, a federal prison in Coleman. And so his health, everybody's health is, plus we're getting older. You know, all these freedom fighters that we're talking about are from the 60s and 70s for the most part, even though some cases occurred later on, but they're of the age of the 60s and 70s, revolutionaries. So now everybody is Herman Bell's age or older. Jalil Abdullah, Imam Jamil Alameen, whose situation, his health is doing very bad, and they sent him all over the place from away from his family. And these are just the ongoing trials and struggles. As an organization, what we try to do is maintain direct contact with each one of the freedom fighters to ensure direct communication with some face, you know, on the street, so we can communicate accurate information about their situations. We have constant programs, including the assisting of the Million Prisoner March that informs the public about these conditions, because I can tell you one reason why it's so important is because there is no better connection in terms of establishing and maintaining our roots, you know, our African roots, African-American roots, our revolutionary roots, you know, in this country. There's no better way to maintain those roots, to be knowledgeable about those roots, than to support those that are alive now, those freedom fighters from that age. Because to ignore them, that defies all logic. Well, everybody's having issues now. We have Rochelle McGee, he's going on 60 years of incarceration. If you just look at some of the numbers now, everybody's being denied parole because of the nature of the case, which is illegal, but so far that's being gotten away with. You can't change the nature of the case if that is the strategy to get out, you know. But even with good conduct like Herman Bell for 20 years, and then, you know, he's vamped upon, but they're constantly being denied parole, and every year that they go up, or every 2 years they go up, you have the Police Benevolent Association in the various states mechanically, automatically send, you know, 5,000 letters out to the parole board, which are probably with a couple of pushes on the computer, of a button on the computer, because they already have this already lined up. You know, so what we would have to do is try to be more creative and come up with strategies that's going to circumvent and override that and put either political or legal pressure on the powers to be to release them.
We have been discussing the recent brutal assault of Herman Bell just a couple of weeks ago. I'm wondering if you could just discuss a little bit the particulars of that incident and what it is that the COs are claiming that Herman Bell did in order for him to have received this write-up, this Tier 3 write-up.
Well, to my understanding so far, the information is that it was a little incident on the yard, and they were clearing out the yard and walking Herman Bell, got him to a point in the yard where there weren't any cameras, and commenced beating him. And they would say he instigated it, you know, for this vicious beating that he received, and then he was locked up, they broke his ribs, and that was that. Well, if anybody knows, out of all of the political prisoners, he would be one of the ones that's been so low-key, you know, so out of trouble if in the context of being incarcerated, so to speak. And like I said, with the record of no incident report and with his wife coming to see him within a day or so, and going up to the parole board in 6 months, it defies any type of logic as to why this situation would exist.
As a former political prisoner yourself, can you just speak a little bit on how difficult and even improbable it is to go 20 full years as a political prisoner inside of these facilities without any kind of infraction?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult. I mean, because so many, you can be stuck with so many different things. You can be put on investigation for a long time. The last 10 years of my incarceration, I didn't get any write-ups. So after going to the parole board about the fourth time, they were saying all the time, well, keep up the good work. After a while, they started saying, we know you're up to something. You can't win for losing. And I did get brutally beaten in prison when I first got there. I was only about 22 or 23. And what did I do? I was a vegetarian, and I took two pieces of fish off the line. They saw me. They took me out. They charged me with stealing government rations. When I went to change out of my kind of knit, I'm old school, so I had my clothes all pressed. It took my pressed clothes away. When I was putting on these ill-fitting clothes, right in the middle of that, they just weighed into me, about 3 or 4 deep, for absolutely no reason. So I know that, I mean, getting beaten in prison is just common as apple pie. There's no provocation. You can't tell me that. He's a setup by Hugo Pinnell. He did all that time in the hole, and after a couple of days after being in the yard, there's a fake fight. Somebody stabs him to death. All this stuff is orchestrated through the prison administration. They're ruthless. And we have to be so vigilant. And now that we're getting older, we don't have the same ability to ward off an attack like we was when we were younger. And this requires for brothers and sisters in the community, all of us, myself included, to exercise maximum vigilance and provide as much support based upon our own capacity, our individual lives, of course, and maybe just go that extra length to sacrifice to just make it happen. You know, send somebody commissary money. Right. We on our website, on the Anarchist Black Cross website, on many of each lot of political prisons have their own defense committees, and Jericho kind of serves as a general umbrella type of thing. It gives you the address and situation for each political prison. You can write them. You can send them commissary money. Send them a book to read. Because there's that daily living that you get a letter from somebody that's showing that they care, that they're concerned, and actually helping you with something. That is the communication. That's the lifeline. And so if you don't know of any organization to join, support, and to help in that way, the least that a person can do is to write somebody a letter. You can go on www.HermanBell. Just Google his name. You can do that on your phone. You know, besides playing all the games on the phone that we have, you can Google somebody's name and you get the address and what their situation is. You don't have to do anything. And just sit there and buy a card from the dollar store. Whatever the procedure is for a prison, just get yourself a $10 money order, whatever it may sometimes is electronically done, and send somebody something for some toothpaste. Because even if they died there, and nobody wants to go there in that place and stay there, but even if they died there, like Majid just died, Mondo Bilanga just died. You know, we're dying in prison. But, you know, as a revolutionary myself, and being there, definitely not 40-some years, I only did 23, but I do know that our mind is such at this strength, just like a person that's not necessarily a political prisoner, there's strength in that individual. You know, and it's even more strength when we know that people love us and they're supporting us. That makes a day. That makes for your day. That makes for your enthusiasm to go another day further. And that's a big help. This is a major thing to be done. So if a room full of 500 people ask, you know, we're ready to get down, you know, what can we do to help? In any given program, we should have the contact information of all those political prisoners, all those freedom fighters, and say, here, everyone write one. And send $20. I mean, that's something straight off the bat. Get the names and numbers, like George Jackson said, after the best rally, if you have not went through the crowd with clipboard in hand, then everybody can go back in the next couple of hours and be Americans again.
Is there anything that those of us on the outside specifically should do for Herman Bell at this moment after this vicious beating that he received inside of the prison?
Yes, there is. For Herman Bell, everybody can go on, just Google Herman Bell. It's going to talk about the incident that happened to him. It's all over the internet. And there you'll find the location where he was transferred to. You can, in your letter, you can write him, you can write the commissioner. His information will be there also, in demanding that Herman Bell be treated with justice and that he receive the ample and appropriate medical attention on time, you know, that the charges be dropped and that this situation be investigated in terms of the guards that did, or whatever you want the field to say, but definitely write him, write the guy named Anucci, and the listener can easily look this up. So everybody listening, you can write Herman Bell. Say, I'm going to write Herman Bell. If you have a family, you can sit down after dinner and get some cards, and everybody's going to write Herman Bell. The children can draw a Herman Bell picture. You can get $20, $25 and send it to them if you have it to spare. You know, once you check the website to see how New York prisoners get their money, so you can do it appropriately. You can't just mail them money. And then you can look on the website, and it'll tell you other ways that you might be able to help as the situation evolves. So that's three things. You know, write Herman Bell directly, write the commissioner of New York with your complaint about what happened as a concerned citizen. And the third, if you're able to, maybe send, you know, $10 or $15. That's directly for Herman Bell right off the bat. You don't have to be a staunch revolutionary activist to do that. You just have to be a concerned individual for the sake of humanity. And then the same can flow over to the other political prisoners. You can get all their addresses on the National Jericho website, www.thejerichomovement.com, and get everybody's update on their cases, where they are, how to write them, what's the latest going on with them, and just say hello. The next thing you can do, you can either become a member of one of these organizations or establish one for yourself. You can do a letter writing every month, write a different prisoner. Look at their birthdays and write them on their birth, send a birthday card. Because this is not only helpful for this mental state of our freedom fighters, but it is also enlightening for the person that does it. It's a real strong sense of doing the right thing.
Jihad Abdul Mumit, chairman of the National Jericho Movement. The news on corporate media is largely fake or non-existent, but there are a few broadcast outlets that serve the people's information needs. One of them is WMXP Radio in Greenville, South Carolina, which is run by the folks at Greenville's Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination. Veteran people's lawyer and activist Afia Wangaza is the center's executive director.
I want to ask folk, even small donors, to give in a more strategic way, in, as I see it, in donating to WMXP and the Malcolm X Center. That is to give in preventative, long-term, empowering, capacity-building ways. We need to supplement our giving with governmental policy demands, demanding that our tax dollars are used in life-affirming ways, demanding that the government defund the military and fully fund even FEMA, as well as healthcare, education, Environmental Protection Agency, and such. I'm reminded of Martin Luther King's 1967 Beyond Vietnam speech, wherein he says, compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It's not haphazard and superficial. Rather, that it comes to a point where we recognize that an edifice which produces beggars needs to be restructured. And a part of that restructuring has to be with us beginning to restructure and reorganize how we donate money. So while responding to the current wave of environmental catastrophes is needed in the richest country in the world, what may be more useful is empowering folk to mobilize and advocate for themselves to prevent catastrophes which victimize us and have us open to being ripped off socially, politically, economically, that we instead donating in such a way as to retain and reinforce the mechanisms that help people to stand up and fight back. And the Malcolm X Center and WMXP 95.5 FM Community Radio certainly does that and has for more than 25 years. We know that if we teach people to fish and to join with others, they can sustain themselves and each other, even forcing polluters to clean up the river after the powers that be have permitted it. As an institution for the past 25 years, the Malcolm X Center has operated a volunteer staff, community center, human rights center, and a radio station, which in the age of fake news is even more critical. We host the annual Malcolm X Festival and Kwanzaa celebrations, which affords cultural literacy and popularization of self-determination, which carries over to our human rights grounded retreats for building a Black agenda. We're a community resource for prison-based cultural literacy classes and programs. With our affiliation with the Pacifica Foundation, other progressive broadcasters, we are able to connect the local community to the national community, identifying the common problems and potential solutions to those problems. We're a catalyst for human rights advocacy, and again, in the age of fake news, is even more critical. We present historical perspective, build common knowledge base for community empowerment and action. We're heard in the local jails and prisons, so we're able to provide information on prisoners' rights to the internees there as well as to their families and friends. WMXP Community Radio is a life-sustaining megaphone for community voices. We're building another generation of media justice advocates and warriors with our youth and community training program, which allows us to be able to train other folk to be able to operate the station. So our goal is to raise $150,000 to retire our mortgage, to make much needed repairs, and to upgrade our equipment. We're asking people to go to our website, which is www.wmxp955.webs.com to make donations. We can be reached at 864-901-8627 for folk who want to make direct contributions, or we can be reached at Post Office Box 16102, Greenville, South Carolina 29606. We'll be setting up a GoFundMe account. It'll be listed on our website so that folk can easily pick it up. But here in the land of Dixie, no contribution is too small, and all are deeply appreciated.
Clearly, WMXP is an asset in the infrastructure of the movement, but what's its operational status right now?
Well, right now, we are still on the air. We operate, of course, with a volunteer staff and recover costs, our basic cost, with local donations. So we're still on the air, still programming, still doing the work that I just described. However, in order for us to continue to do that beyond December 31st of this year, we must retire the mortgage.
And I would think that the powers that be in the Greenville-Spartanburg area would be very glad to see WMXP go off the air.
Absolutely. That's their fondest objective, especially law enforcement and the misleadership class that keeps us going down primrose paths and dead ends. WMXP and the Malcolm X Center, which is a human rights institute, is the lifeline in Greenville. And it's a part of a larger effort of conscious Black radio stations around the country, as well as progressive white stations, to work together in order to build a movement in this country that addresses the needs of the people, a human rights movement, a people-centered human rights movement.
And for our listeners, if you just put WMXP in your search engine, Google or any other one, the radio station's website pops right up.
Exactly.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.